On Gesundheit with Jacobus this Saturday morning, I will interview Dr. Robert Linden, board certified in geriatrics and internal medicine. After retiring early 2008, he wrote a book called The Rise and Fall of the American Medical Empire, a trench doctor's view of the past, present, and future of the U.S. healthcare system. Agree with him or not, Dr. Linden will give in-depth views into today's pharmaceutical and insurance industries, hospitals, medical schools, malpractice, litigation, and government programs both here and abroad this Saturday morning from 8 to 11.
Welcome to Gesundheit with Jacobus, Health Talk Radio, integrating allopathic and all-natural medicine one show at a time. Here is your host, Jacobus Hollewein.
And good morning, everybody. Welcome to the program. It's great to be with you. It's a wonderful, wonderful show. Chuck is laughing. We had a little mishap right here, but my goodness, Chuck, are we there? Good morning to you.
Good morning. You work so well under pressure. I am amazed. Just amazed.
We lost our guest. I don't know what I pressed, but we lost him. So we had to get him back while the music was playing. Dr. Robert Linden will be on the phone with me, and we're going to be talking about his book, The Rise and Fall of the American Medical Empire. And I'm sure that you're going to really enjoy this. So, stay tuned, hopefully, till 11 o'clock. We hope you can do that with us. Let me tell you a little bit about the program, first of all, that is always important. We are talking every Saturday morning from 8 to 11 about health, healing, and healthy lifestyles. We do it with the experts, give them a chance to chat about their profession or a topic of their choice, and then give them a chance to really dig deep for 3 hours and talk about the details. As always, when we talk about health, healing, and healthy lifestyles, I highly recommend that you keep in mind that we are here to educate, entertain, and inform. We're not here to diagnose, treat, or cure. We always recommend that after the program, you see a specialist or physician of your choice and read more information about the topic at hand so that you will just be totally up to date and can do the best for yourself or for somebody close to you. So once again, I appreciate your tuning in today. So, Dr. Linden, on December 31st, 2007, Dr. Linden walked away from primary care, internal medicine, and geriatrics, and from his career treating close friends and neighbors. It was a difficult decision, but he was tired. His practice of medicine had come first for over 30 years, his family second, and he himself third. A strong need to reconnect with loved ones and to re-energize his own body had developed. But along with this burned the desire within to impart a behind-the-scenes knowledge garnered over time by this small-town doc concerning the massive problems emerging from and percolating within the American medical system. Thus, the reason for the rise and fall of the American medical empire. Along the way, he came to realize that guilt was present as well. He had retired at too early an age. So for patients across the country and friends nearby, this book is for you. Dr. Robert Linden received a BA from Cornell University in 1971 and his medical doctor degree from Cornell University Medical College in 1975. He performed his internship and residency at the University of Tennessee in Memphis. Board certified in internal medicine and geriatrics, Dr. Linden is also a fellow in the American College of Physicians. He has 3 grown children and resides with his wife Karen in southeastern Connecticut. His book was an award-winning finalist in the Best New Nonfiction category of the Best Books 2010 Awards, sponsored by USA Books Book News. He is also winner in the current events category of the 2010 Next Generation Indie Book Awards. There are several ways where you can reach him. He is on Facebook. Go to Rise and Fall of the American Medical Empire. And the book is brought out by SunriseRiverPress.com. SunriseRiverPress.com. You can go to that website and find other books that are very good, and you can order the book from there as well. The book is available locally. I do know that Borders on 19th, Borders has a bunch of copies available. I think they're running about $18.95 or so. I highly recommend you check it out, read, you learn a ton. And we have so much to talk about. Dr. Linden, thank you so very much for being with us this morning. How are you doing?
Oh, very good. Thanks, Jacobus, for having me.
Well, you're very welcome. And I'm glad we've had a chance to chat a couple times before the show. And I'm just amazed with the information that you have. There is so much to talk about. And I've been doing all these introductions. I'm just curious. Can you tell us a little bit more about you? You say, indeed, in the introduction, I say you retire too early. Tell us a little bit about what brought you to write this book.
Well, you know, my background, actually, like you summarized, it really impacts the way I practice medicine and wrote the book. So I'll spend a little bit of time, if I have the time, to kind of go over that. I grew up in New York State, in Rye, New York, which is on the border of Connecticut and New York.
Yeah.
And attended public high schools there, and basically a town very similar to where I am now in Southeast Connecticut, both in size and population. Went on to, like you said, Cornell University in upstate New York. I had a family lineage dating back to 1914. My grandfather had gone there, both my parents.
Yeah, five generations or so.
Right.
Yeah.
And and I really want to go there, and I got in and traveled up to Ithaca, New York, where the university is. And I loved it up there. I you know, basically rode crew for 4 years, fraternity life, worked very hard. My SATs, my high school tests weren't quite what the other people at Cornell were, but basically I worked very hard, you know, in high school and got in, and I enjoyed it. There was a tradition at Cornell undergrad where, and I didn't realize this when I joined the crew team, but my grandfather had been a coxswain back in 1914, and I wanted to row. I'd never rowed before. But there actually turned out to be a tradition where one Cornell oarsman went to the Cornell's medical school in New York City every year.
Yeah.
And although, again, my CUME average was nowhere near what the other people that went from Cornell undergrad to Cornell Med was, but I got in.
Well, congratulations.
And the problem, however, and that started my whole entrance into the medical field, is the problem is I love, like I said, Cornell undergrad, bucolic, countryside. The medical school is in New York City, and it was in the Upper East Side of Manhattan, which is a very wealthy area. And the main teaching hospital for Cornell Medical College was New York Hospital, which was a large private hospital catered to the rich and famous, the famous movie stars, things like that. And the people that were admitted there weren't particularly sick, or they had very esoteric diseases like lupus and scleroderma, things you would not see in the real world on a,
right,
on a common basis. And that's why I want to be a primary care internal medicine physician. So I spent my 4 years there really not enjoying it and really not considering that as a continuation of Cornell Med. Thank God I had met this person in undergrad, and actually you appreciate this. He's a Dutchman. His name was Bill van der Rijt.
yeah, I saw his name.
Was born in the Netherlands. His family had moved to Canada and then to Long Island. He was a year ahead of me at Cornell, and I met him when I was a freshman on the crew team because I rode with him. And he was in my fraternity. And it was interesting that he, midway through our undergraduate career there, fell in love with this girl next to him in biology class. And her name, another Dutchman, was Kirby van Brocklin.
Yes.
And Kirby was the daughter of Norm van Brocklin. And for some of the listeners who don't know Norm, he was a famous football player, played for University of Oregon, went on to quarterback to L.A. Rams and Philadelphia Eagles, and then actually became the first football coach for the Minnesota Vikings. And Norm had moved to Atlanta for the Atlanta Falcons to coach there, and that was the time we were in medical, actually in undergrad. And Bill, when he graduated, went down to Atlanta with Kirby. And I used to visit him every year, and he entered actually Emory Medical College, and down there I actually took a 5-week rotation my fourth year in Cornell Med down there, and their teaching hospital is a Grady Memorial Hospital, a very large inner city public hospital. The patients were really sick; they had they're underserved, they're, you know, poor, but they had the diseases you see every day in private practice, you know, diabetes, hypertension, heart attacks, lung disease, the stuff that I was going to treat. So when I finished Cornell Med, I actually decided to head down south, and I applied to Emory in Atlanta, where my friends were. And also, my advisor said, you know, you're crazy going down south. Nobody from Cornell, in a really arrogant way, he said, nobody from Cornell has ever gone to internship south of Duke. Mm. But if you want to do that, there's another program similar to Emory's at the University of Tennessee. So I applied to both of them and ended up at Tennessee. A little bit of a shock. It was about 4 or 5 years after Martin Luther King was killed, and it was still a quite segregated city versus Atlanta, which was relatively cosmopolitan at that point. I think there were only two Northerners in my whole internship class, person from Michigan and myself, and they took me over under their wing. They called me in one day and said, the other intern said, we're going to, you know, turn you into a Southern redneck in 3 years. but it didn't happen, but it was a great experience because the city hospital, again, was an inner city hospital. It was one of the last welfare hospitals with wards, you know, 20, 30 people per room. Patients were just separated by, you know, thin curtains. But I learned a lot. And the other great thing about the place was that basically the head of medicine was Gene Stolleman. And Dr. Stolleman was famous at that point for all his work in rheumatic fever and the cause of rheumatic fever, which was group A beta hemolytic strep coming from strep throats. But the other thing about him was he was the ultimate in bedside clinicians. I mean, he was basically brought everybody to the bedside and would teach us 80% of your diagnosis should come from a comprehensive history, 10% from a hands-on physical exam, and maybe 10% from testing. And if the testing, if you ordered the testing that didn't agree with your assessment by your history and physical, you threw out the testing. And I really learned...
You know, you mentioned that real quick, if I interrupt you, but when I was reading that, that just caught my attention when this doctor was doing this because it is indeed missing. There is a certain intuition, maybe, that you combine with your knowledge, your book knowledge, and there is the intuition, and then there is the connection with the patient. And it sounds to me that this doctor is really showed you how to connect with the patient and get a reading out of what he or she is telling you. And then what you say, indeed, if in doubt, take a test. But if you don't like the test result, kind of throw that out and go with your guts.
Exactly. And it almost always worked. And it really got you closer to the patient, number one. Plus, you know, you get led down the primrose path with tests because, you know, the history is the most important key to solving a medical problem and not a test. And so basically, I left University of Tennessee after 3 years. I finished my residency, and actually, that Gene Stolleman. When I was writing the book, I figured this man was dead and buried years ago. But I started to go on to the internet looking for him, and sure enough, he's still kicking, still a rebel.
Wow.
Lives up in outside Dartmouth. Apparently, there's something outside Hanover, New Hampshire, where Dartmouth is, called ILLiad, Institute for Lifelong Education at Dartmouth. And these are like 1,500 to 2,000 people who retire to the Hanover area specifically to stimulate their minds. They're retired physicians and lawyers and veterinarians, and they teach each other. They give actuary courses, just like Dartmouth course, a trimester, and they teach six classes a year on a trimester basis to the other people in ILLiad. And about what they've done in their life and other things. And so he's up there, 89 years old, still teaching.
Wow.
Jeez, amazing guy. His mind is just sharp as could be. Just to really, again, like I said, a giant in medicine and still is.
Yeah.
And so I really, you know, from the sick people I saw, from the hands-on medicine at Tennessee, Cornell practiced a lot from the back pocket of their pants. They cited literature, New England Journal and JAMA and stuff like that. But as far as really hands-on medicine on sick people, it wasn't at Cornell, but it was at Tennessee. And I really learned to take care of the entire patient there. So after 3 years at Tennessee, that's the residency is for internal medicine. I got back together again with a friend of mine who I met at Cornell undergrad, who we wanted to open up a practice together. And we with our wives started to discuss where we wanted to settle. And, you know, Dave Thompson, my partner to be, you know, first said, let's go back to Ithaca. Well, I know you guys out there in Montana wouldn't flinch at this.
Yeah.
But
a little
there was
cold.
A week, my, what?
It was a little cold over there.
Yeah. Yeah. There was a week my freshman year where I never got above 25 below zero. And I just said, Dave, I can't do that the rest of my life. I could do that as a young buck, as a college student, but I for the rest of my life I can't do that. So I said, okay, let's go to actually Bar Harbor, Maine. Well, that was where his father had a summer home. And I said, that's even worse. I mean, it's in the northern section of Maine, and it is really cold. Yeah. So I said, let's hop in our car with our wives. We'll drive along Connecticut's coast, which is somewhat temperate, and it gives me the water to row, and it gives you skiing if you go a little north. And so we drove through Fairfield County, which is a really wealthy area of Connecticut, which I didn't want to settle in because it was too much like Cornell. And we took the first two hospitals after Yale, which were Lawrence Mill Hospital in New London, Connecticut, and Wesley, Rhode Island, and felt the New London Hospital was much better. So we picked out Southeast Connecticut, started looking for towns to settle in. And doctors are funny, you know. They'll even though an area needs doctors, you go to a doctor and say, hey, I'm here, I want to practice, how you need doctors in your town, and they go, no, but they need doctors over there. And so we went back and forth, and finally found a town, East Lyme, Connecticut, and the internist said, you know, we need doctors here. And then when I found out the town, the high school, public high school, had a rowing team, and at that point, back in the 70s, there was just a handful of public high schools with rowing. I said, this is obviously the chosen one has picked this town for us. And so we settled in the southern part of the town, which is called Niantic, and we've been here ever since. And opened the practice in 1978, and I was a board certified internist. Ten years into the practice, I had sort of a soul searching period where I was, you know, as we'll go through probably a little bit when we get into the what's happened to primary care, medical schools really sort of dump on primary care physicians. You know, they look down upon them. We're called LMDs, local medical doctors, and I even don't like the word PCP, which stands for primary care physician. But I was tired of being called an LMD, and I wanted to sort of develop some, you know, improve my credentials, so to speak. And so I basically, when internal medicine has a new subspecialty, and in this case it was 1988 geriatrics treatment of older patients, they'll let people who have not taken the fellowship, it's another 2 or 3 year fellowship, but if they open up start the new specialty, they'll allow doctors in practice already who do a lot of that specialty to kind of sit for the test with the people that have just finished a 2 or 3 year fellowship. So I did that and became board certified in geriatrics. At the same time, there's a academic group called American College Physicians. It's an academic group for internists, and they have a stratification. You can become a member and then a fellow. To be a fellow, you have to do a lot of research and publish papers. But they had just started a new track where you could actually, if you taught doctors, if you were involved with teaching, and I was because I was, you know, I was writing a newsletter for our hospital on pharmacy when I was head of the pharmacy committee, and I was on our risk management committee of our medical malpractice company. I was going around the state teaching doctors about malpractice and holding seminars, and so I presented that information, became a fellow in the American College Physician. So between those two things, they sort of satisfied my need for credentials, knowing internally that I was just not an LMD, that I could probably be hired by any academic medical center in the country. But I still loved primary care medicine, and we stayed in, and I practiced in Niantic up through into 2007, like you said. 2006 came, and I was starting to really tire out. I mean, medicine, as we'll go through in a little bit, especially primary care medicine is getting tougher and tougher. And what happened was I'm compulsive, and I closed my practice. I mean, we took a third partner in 1984. And then by the time 1988 came, and we took our fourth partner, and my practice was gigantic and overflowing. So I closed my practice after 10 years to taking new patients. But you know, with my reeducation in Tennessee, taking care of the whole patient, and I found that social specialists weren't helping me. You know, as probably you found, and probably a lot of the listeners have found, you know, social specialists get into the procedures. You know, if you're a GI guy, all you do is turn out those colonoscopies. If you're a cardiologist, you know, the cardiac casts. But they sort of lost the knack a lot in different, you know, going to the bedside, taking a good history and physical, and making a differential diagnosis. And so I didn't feel that they were helping me any on that. So I really did most of my stuff myself. I couldn't do colonoscopies or cardiac casts, but I kept people in-house, and I really did most of the care of my heart patients and my lung patients and my diabetics myself. And what I was finding was that these patients were getting, you know, basically as they got older. When I started practice, my patients were 40, 50, 60 years old. But now, 30 years later, they were, you know, 70, 80, and 90 years old. And where they started with 2 or 3 diseases, now they had 10. And they're on 15 medicines, and and the day was getting longer and longer. So I was considering looking for somebody to replace me, but we had, for a variety of reasons, not anything to do with me, we had looked in the journals with ads over the last 10 or 15 years, and every time we put an ad in for a new person, the number of the people answering the ads, the quality just started sinking. You know, less and less people were interested in internal medicine. Their credentials were very questionable, You know, we didn't take anybody. So, but somehow somebody fell into my lap. You know, my partner that I started the practice with, again, he had a patient in Niantic who had friends in Ohio. And one day, about 6 or 7 years ago, the patient came in and said, you know, we have friends in Ohio and their son's in medical school. You might want to call them. And my partner started a conversation with him on the phone once or twice a year. And finally, in 2006, he called me. And this guy had great credentials. He's magna cum laude at Case Western Reserve, did medical school in Ohio, was finished up at Cleveland Clinic, one of the top 3 or 5 academic institutions in the country. And he came, visited a couple times, and said he wanted to join. So basically, he came September 2007. I was planning actually to work through June of 2008. It's an interesting story on that.
I want to hear it because I just love listening to how you explain everything and your involvement. Well, we're going to hit a short break here. So when we come back, let's continue with that. Okay.
Okay. Okay.
We are going to be right back. And we're back on the program, Dr. Robert Linden with us talking about his new book. We very much appreciate you with us. Dr. Linden was continuing his talk about how he was getting out of the practice and found somebody who could help him to take over the practice. Dr. Linden, good morning.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good, thank you very much.
Still here.
I'm glad. That's very helpful for me today.
So you
were looking for somebody, and
right.
You said, indeed, you know, when you have a certain attitude, and like you say, there is a certain compulsiveness in you, but I think it is more the passion that you have for caring about people. And it like I said in the introduction, you put your patient first, your family second, yourself third. It's something I resonate with. My wife will tell you that when you really enjoy what you're doing, you never work a day in your life. But at the same time, there is a possibility that you end up doing so much work. And then when you're doing what you're doing, but the whole industry around you is changing for whatever reason, it's changing, and you go like, whoa, wait a second, you know, that's not really the direction we should be going. Then you get frustrated with all of a sudden the bureaucracy that comes up, all the paperwork that you have to take care of, the way that patients are reacting, the way that the media is portraying the medical field, the food industry is changing and letting people eat junk that makes them sick. And you go like, whoa, you know, I'm working uphill here. There's no way to get out of this. And so I understand that you get tired at some point. And I don't know if that was one of the reasons why you hit that point that you say, you know, maybe I should retire. But so you were looking for somebody who may be able to take over your practice.
Right. And it was interesting, like what you just said, because I was listening to a CD from the American College of Physicians yesterday on concierge medicine, which we can discuss a little later. And I mean, it was just one physician after another is kind of giving the same story. And the choices are very few. I mean, when you sort of get tired out or burned out, I mean, you can continue doing what you're doing and sort of die at your desk one night at 10 o'clock, which is what I was afraid was going to happen to me. You can give in and sort of give in to manage health care and give in to, you know, the paperwork and start to become a mediocre doctor and not fight for your patient, not be an advocate for your patient anymore. Or you can sort of get at the top and do something different. And I decided, I always likened myself to sort of Sandy Koufax. I said, you know, I'm not going to give in to this. I'm not going to become cynical. I'm not going to become a mediocre doctor. I'm going to work at the top of my game for my patients as their advocate until I can't do it anymore, then get out. And in essence, like you said, that's the reason for the book, because I did feel guilty. And this was just a way of transitioning from taking care of 2,000 people that I took care of in the office to maybe something like going from private practice to public health, where a public health physician, you know, creates rules and regulations and does studies for the entire nation to teach everybody. And that's what, you know, I kind of envisioned the book as, which was an educational tool plus plus something to vent my frustration because I felt a little guilty. I'm in a small town, 15,000 people, and the patients are my, you know, friends and neighbors, like you said, or at the opening of the show, and yeah. And I just didn't want to abandon them, and I wanted to continue to be their advocate. And I think they understood. They said, you know, we understand you were going to die there one night, and you had to get out, but thanks for the book. So
So
the new guy came in September of 2007, and I was going to stay on till June of 2008. And to get him accustomed to the practice. And it was an interesting story because it kind of gives a little sidelight and a little bit of inroad into what happens in malpractice companies. But for physicians specifically, when we came to Connecticut, the main malpractice company in Connecticut for doctors was Aetna. But the problem was they were settling all the cases. I mean, they basically have a patient sued a physician, Aetna settled without the okay of the doctor. And what happens when that happens is even cases that are not malpractice get paid to patients, and patients and lawyers come to understand that, and then everybody's suing doctors all over. So we dropped Aetna, and the doctors of Connecticut went to CNA, who said they would require, you know, they would have the doctor involved with decisions and would not settle unless the doctor said okay.
Yeah.
But then the CNA went up, started going up in their premium. So we started our own company called CMIC, Connecticut Medical Insurance Company, back in the early 80s. And I had just been sued on a case with Yale, and I was a little upset with it because I thought I'd done nothing wrong. And so I asked to be placed on the risk management committee of CMIC and ended up on that for like 17 years and ended up on the board of directors for about 12 years of that company.
Okay.
And the first crisis we went through was with the obstetricians, and as many of the listeners know, you know, the problem with OOB is when you have in the medical practice area, it's called a bad baby case. But if you have the baby comes out and it's malformed or something's wrong with it, it may not have anything to do with the obstetrician and he or she did. But it settles for $1 to $3 million automatically.
Oh,
so these malpractice companies became quickly to dislike obstetricians. And what they did was they jacked up, and this is back in the early 1990s, jacked up premiums to over $100,000, and obstetricians had to leave malpractice companies and form their own or form gigantic specialty groups or just go bare without any insurance. I could understand where I was coming from, but as I sat on this board, I started to see our internist premiums going up. They're over 3 years. We went from $5,000 per doctor to $8,000. To $15,000 to finally $22,000 a year for our malpractice insurance, and the reasoning was quote unquote internists were getting sued for delay in diagnosis or misdiagnosis, but
really?
I could not see this price going quadrupling in 3 years, 3 or 4 years, and my partners, you know, we had a meeting, and my partner said, you know, we have to leave this company, just we can't stay with, and this is a company that we formed with our money, it's a mutual company owned and operated by doctors. And they had priced us out of their. So we went to another company from Massachusetts, another mutual company owned by the Massachusetts doctors called ProMutual, and their premiums were like half of CMIC's, and we stayed with them. And then all of a sudden, one day it was really interesting. One day they came and looked at our, came and surveyed our office, and I didn't. It was a funny story because my partner, who takes care of most of the business part of our practice, had mentioned to us that the malpractice company may be coming to survey the office, but he never told when they were coming, and he took a vacation. He went on vacation, and sure enough, this person from the malpractice company showed up, and I didn't know the person. I thought it was somebody interviewing for a job. So our practice, I don't think we'd be considered a really super professional practice. We joked with our patients. I would walk people out to the front desk. We'd be joking with other people in the waiting room. You know, with HIPAA regulations now, you know, that stuff is frowned upon. You know, it's all confidentiality.
Yes.
But so this person was behind the desk, and they were talking to our staff, and I didn't think anything of it. And I was joking with the patient at the window. And the bottom line is, we get a letter from the malpractice company claiming that, number one, we don't have a glass partition between the office staff and the waiting room. And I was always dead set against that because I think that just patients hate glass partitions. They really look at doctors saying, well, you prima donna, you can't, you know, you close your, you know, it's like a bulletproof, you know, basically in a bulletproof window in a seedy motel. You know, they're opening and shutting these windows.
Yeah,
and they kind of cite us because our x-ray license wasn't up on the wall. It was in one of our desks, and we had a license for our lab, but that wasn't posted on the wall. They didn't like our handwriting, and they formulated this list of things, and they sent it to my partner, who I think he's kind of a little bit. He runs our IP in our state, our HMO IPA. And he really kind of considers himself a little bit untouchable, and I think he got ticked off with the letter and threw it in the circular file, you know, in the waste bin. Didn't tell anybody about it. And the next thing we get was basically the fall of that year when the new guy had come, 2007, a letter saying they're not insuring us anymore after January 1st, 2008.
Oh.
And we said why, and they wouldn't really tell us. I mean, they just basically said you got this letter, and we never heard anything. And we didn't know anything about the letter. My partner claims he never got it.
I'm not sure.
But it was clear that they wanted internists out also. They were kicking internists out, and this is how they were going to do it. So my partner had a meeting with them, a closed meeting. He didn't let anybody else go in. Came back to us and said, you know, basically, we work something out. You know, they'll insure the four of us, but Lyndon, who's retiring in 6 months, they don't want to insure him anymore. I had to actually hang it up as of December 2007, and then they went ahead and they actually surcharged doctors. If they don't like the doctor, they actually throw another surcharge, and there's a 25% increase in our premiums for 3 or 4 years.
Wow.
And it's amazing because nobody in my practice had ever been sued, you know, lost a malpractice suit. There's something called the National Practitioner Data Bank, which basically which is a data bank where physicians that are either sued and have to settle or lose a case, or if you've had problems with Medicare or hospital privileges or the Drug Enforcement Agency, they get thrown into this data bank so you can look at physicians, see the bad guys, you know. And none of us were in that. And this, yet this insurance company was kicking us out. So,
wow.
So I kind of, you know, basically left December 2007. It turns out my brother-in-law lives in Cape Cod, and actually his next-door neighbor happens to be the head of the board of directors of the ProMutual company in Massachusetts. And I questioned them a couple times on why I was not reinsured, and at least for the next 6 months until June of 2008, and never got anything back. And finally he talked to them, and I got a letter saying that, well, I wasn't reinsured because my notes weren't signed. They're always signed. They weren't dated. They're always dated. And they couldn't, and my handwriting was terrible. Well, you know, what else is new, you know? And, you know, most people are thrown out of a company or not reinsured.
I actually thought that doctors are taught to write horrible in the medical school because it's always, you can never read what they write.
You have to write quickly, and in my case, we did not have electronic medical records or dictation, and I was compulsive on that, too, and I put everything down in the record so I could read it, and I consider that confidentiality. Nobody else could read it, so the patients could feel safe that their records were confidential.
Yes.
I could read it. My partners could read it, so there was not a problem there, and if anybody really, an insurance company, wanted a record or, you know, I typed it up and sent it out so they could read it, or if it was a consult to somebody else, it was typed up. So there was not a problem with that. And most doctors that are not reinsured, you know, they're not reinsured because they have egregious malpractice suits or they've lost multiple lawsuits and things like that. So this is news to us. But the bottom line is I walked out December 2007. I took several days off to, again, like you said, re-energize myself. And then I started this book and I started my adventure of writing my book, which took the next year to finish.
Wow, that is what a great story! But at the same time, I hear every word you say, and I can just visualize that Adres indeed has become whoever started the industry around you. The change in the industry, it is you have to conform with that. And for whatever reason, they write down like it is not hygienic or it is not it's not appropriate, or we are indeed a different breed. We are separate from our patients. We're not one of them. We are above them. Whatever started that, you go like, no. This is not how I was trained. And like you mentioned, Dr. Gene Stolloman and his inspiration that he had on you, that is indeed what most people would like to have in a doctor, that they say, you know what, I'm opening myself up here. I'm talking about some really deep-seated issues that come up, or some bad pains or this disorder that I have that I need to have a question, that I have a question about and want to have an answer for. They want to talk to a doctor, and they want to feel that they're connecting with the doctor so that they actually get some sound advice. And therefore, I think the time that a doctor needs to spend with a patient is maybe more at one visit and less at another visit. You cannot just make a cookie cutter type of visit system whereby you say we have 5 to 10 minutes and you're in and out the door. Some people take more time than others. And when you try to do that and the system around you says, no, we're going to change it, you all of a sudden end up being the rebel, even though you go by the whole idea behind the doctor. So how can you make a diagnosis if you don't understand the person you're working with? And when you look at the physician's desk reference, the PDR of prescription drugs, and you see how thick that book is with everything it explains about when to take it, how to take it, the side effects, what you cannot take with it, what contraindicates. Nobody understands that book by heart. How can you just say, well, take this? And like you mentioned earlier, the overprescribing of patients that many people have 5 to 15 medications every day. And as they get older, it only becomes more medications. There is nothing wrong with medication. It is just that when things become too much and for too long a period of time, there is a problem. And as a doctor, you need to go back and say, hey, wait a second. What was again the problem that we're trying to treat you for? Instead of just going after the symptoms and trying to treat the symptoms, and I feel I can totally understand that you got frustrated with it, and that you the best thing you could have done indeed is write a book.
Right.
So that you then talk about it. And I appreciate you spent your time with us on the radio program today. There is indeed a lot we need to talk about. Maybe we can talk a little bit about the, what are we going to do?
Well, just a couple of comments on what you were saying. Yes. It's interesting because I agree with you completely about the professionals and thing. I mean, I think doctors do sort of talk down to patients way too often. The way I ran the practice, my mother-in-law could kill me because my wife's father was a pediatrician in New Jersey and always drove the Cadillac and dressed well. And I would drive through town in my old Land Cruiser with my shirt off, and she would just shirk and go nuts. And the practice was always a funny practice. My partner's father was head of Cornell New York Medical College, and I mean head of the New York Hospital, and was on boards and things. So we came to town. There was a sort of a wealthy area that he actually moved into, and these were people, those summer people. They came up from New York City and Wall Street and Hartford and Washington, D.C., and he took care of those people. I took care of the plumbers and electricians and things like that because they're more my type. And I really enjoyed that. And so it was sort of down-home, country medicine.
Yeah.
The tape yesterday was really interesting because it brought home the thing again about individualizing. And the problem was one doctor said, the reason I picked concierge medicine is because, I was just tired of the patient coming in with 10 problems and their daughter would come in who was a PhD who had another 5 questions and I couldn't do this in 15 minutes. And so I gave up my regular practice and cut it to this concierge thing, which is, treating 500 people, in your total practice and requiring to pay cash, as a yearly retainer fee, anything from like $1,000 to $7,000. The problem is that that patient isn't common. I mean, and what happened, what I did is, so if somebody had too many problems to go over, I told them, tell you what, look, I really have to go into the next patient, but I'll call you after office hours and we'll go over it. Or if it really required an exam, I said, look, I'm finishing up at 6:37 tonight. Come on back at 7:30. I'm doing some, paperwork and knock on the front door and come in and we'll finish this off. And that's the way I got around it. I extended my hours longer, which a lot of people won't do anymore.
Right.
But that's how you do it. You don't give into the system and then get rid of 3/4 of your practice and demand cash from the other quarter and say you're setting up a concierge practice. I mean, I don't think that should be done. I think it's somewhat unethical.
Yeah.
But it's sweeping the country now.
Yeah.
Talk about a little later.
Hmm. Wow, that is that's good. That's true. Now you want to talk a little bit about the primary care physician, the whole idea of what is a primary care physician, because it is indeed, as you mentioned in your book, the numbers are dwindling, and there are different reasons for that. It is the income, it is the malpractice insurance, just the long hours. If you're really passionate about what you do, and I have the same thing. My wife says too, I work too many hours, but when you really love what you're doing, it really is something that it's all part of the same thing. There's just different spokes in the wheel, so to say, and everything needs to be greased and everything needs to be taken care of. But there has to be indeed a balance in life, and I realize that as well. And I'm sure you have a lot more time on your hands right now. But at the same time, when you see all the people with the problems now, I also feel, Dr. Linden, that at times there needs to be the education part whereby we tell people, listen, if you really were concerned about your health, there are certain things you need to do in order to make these office visits less frequent. And that means that people have to learn how to start taking care of themselves better and not come in with every little problem that is going on with them. So I feel when you talk about the problems in the field of medicine today, in the healthcare system, there is too much emphasis indeed on dependency on doctors and specialists. There is not enough, focus on what can we do to take care of people. And as you often talk, not you, but in general, we often talk about comparing a person taking care of themselves to taking care of your car. If you only get one car in your life, which is your body, how well would you take care of it? You would make sure you buff it up and you change the oil and you do the, you make sure it's all, it's kept in the garage at times and you're careful on the road. You don't want to bump into anything. And I see that people are many people are very lackadaisical about their body and they're not always respecting their body enough that it is actually very vulnerable. And so what I try to do with the program such as this, and when I talk to people on a daily basis, is to try to help them to understand that there are many tools available in grocery stores and in books and libraries, etc., where they can learn how to get a stronger immune system so that they can start taking care of themselves, and that you as a physician are just there to help the people when there really is a problem and things are out of whack and show them how to get back into shape. You see my point?
Right. I agree. I think that, you know, what you say comes home because, basically the medical schools, I think at this point, are very disease driven. I mean, and it comes back to what's happened to primary care and why it's disappearing because it's disappearing. We're actually going to a subspecialist-based model. And the medical schools treat patients as diseases, not patients. When you start to do that, then you get into this whole thing about everything is treated by drugs, and everything is treated and worked up with tests.
That's right.
And you get out of that Dr. realm Linden, of primary care.
We're going to have to run for the break here. When we come back, we're going to talk about that more. We'll be right back. And we do have a caller, Dr. Linden. It's good to have. Can you turn Dr. Linden on, please, too? All right, here we are. And we have a caller on hold who would like to talk to you. Caller, good morning. Your name, please. How can we help you?
This is Lee.
Hello, Lee.
I'm just a quick background. I'm also a retired physician.
Uh-huh.
Just recently retired, 2006.
Uh-huh.
And I spent a good deal of my professional career in private practice as well as academic medicine. I'm a specialist, a radiologist, specialties in trauma, emergency, breast imaging, and nuclear medicine.
Awesome.
And a couple of observations that Dr. Linden made is very interesting. As I noticed, as you know, my career was going on, I would listen to the residents, because we were a big academic institution, talking in conferences, and I would listen to the background, and they would all talk about how brilliant somebody was or how that, but they never talked anywhere, anytime, about whether they were compassionate or not. You know, the person might have a terrible personality. The radiologist or the resident could have a terrible personality, but they would say, "Oh, but they're so bright." You know, all the emphasis was always on what papers could you write or what test. And I also served on a county medical practice review committee. And one of the other things that was very interesting that Dr. Linden made is we very rarely reviewed a case where a doctor got in trouble for ordering a test. It was usually for not ordering a test.
Oh.
So, you know, if you look at what he says, the emphasis, it's been there for a long, long time. That's, you know, and then his other comment about people, one of the things I've always thought is the American public also needs to take some responsibility for their own health care. You just can't show up at the doctor's office after 20 years of neglect and say, fix me. It just doesn't work that way.
Yes,
as we all know.
Well, yeah. That's a great point. Dr. Linden, you have a comment about that.
Oh, I agree. I think that's the issue about the, you know, sort of, you know, how the medical schools view this is basically what I think is a downfall of primary care at this point. I think that medical schools, for some reason, reward the docs that can cite the studies that basically order more testing, because to them that sort of means you're more knowledgeable about this stuff and you get the A, and the resident or the student that goes to the bedside does a good history and physical and then says we don't need any further testing, this is what I think we should do based on that, is looked at, is frowned upon. And I think that basically, so what we're turning out is a group of physicians that basically learn to test, and not to ask a lot of questions. And that, unfortunately, you know, continues on into private practice.
Yes.
Where they continue to test, and they don't develop the skills at the bedside, and they do depend on testing, and that's where we end up with our high-tech, expensive way of treating people. These are the people that are bright, and I think that in the old days, you know, people ended up, you know, in internal medicine residency 50% of the time. I mean, but now, obviously, is, you know, we may get into with the death of primary care. I mean, only 20% of the medical school graduates are going into internal medicine residencies.
Yeah.
I think that a lot of this is medical school. I don't know how they approach students, and I think they're going to have to change.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. I was always a big advocate of family practice, and I always thought, you know, my advocate was when patients would come in, they'd say, well, what specialist should I see? You know, or if I did a radiology test and I found something, I'd say, you know, a good primary care physician should be the coach of the team. And
totally.
They'll tell you, you know, what specialist you need. And I was criticized for that at times, like, oh, well, you know, well, we should do this special MRI, or we should do that. And I always ask the question, I'd say, you know, why are we doing it? What are you looking for? And what are you going to do with the results? And if you couldn't give me an answer to that, then why are we starting with that test? And periodically, I would get in a big discussion with colleagues and certainly with the residents about that particular.
But that's really interesting, Lee, because that's what Bob is saying. He feels that the primary care physician is the quarterback on your team. I mean, that's the one who knows the game. He knows which way you can go and then says, okay, this is what we should do first. But when you know all the aspects, it's much easier to tell the patient, you know, hey, whoa, don't go overboard right now. We can do this and this and this right now and start working on it and educate the patient about how they really should take care of themselves, because that's always the cheapest way to go.
In the long run, it was. We would have patients come in and demand. At one time, there was a big push toward the whole body CT scans, looking for almost anything. And we would have patients come in directly demanding to have one. And, you know, I used to be so perplexed by it. I'd say, well, why are we doing that? Well, they heard it from somebody, or they saw it on television, or a friend told them that. And I'd say, but if we find a tiny spot, what are we going to do about it? Because we need to know about the rest of you. And sometimes you would get into big discussions about it. And many physicians would go ahead and just do the test because they didn't want to risk being sued. Because I had patients say, well, if you don't do this test, I'll sue you. And I'd time, you'd have to sit down and spend time and discuss it with the patient, what you were doing, why we were doing it, and why, you know, we had that particular approach to a problem. And time, you usually, you know, the patient would come around and say, oh, yeah, okay, that makes sense.
Mm.
But that takes time. And, you know, when you've got a big list or a nurse standing there fingering the chart saying you're getting behind, there's a push to not do that.
I see.
Exactly. Exactly.
Okay, I'll let you go.
Thanks,
my observation.
Lee.
Thanks for the comments. Yep.
Yeah,
great.
Appreciate it.
You're welcome.
Nice.
Bye-bye.
All righty. We have another caller. Caller, good morning to you. Thanks for your patience. What is your name? How can we help you, please?
This is Whatchamacallit. Were you talking about me on this program?
Probably will.
Yeah, you used the word Whatchamacallit. Well, here, let me go into a little anecdote and a big question. You know, one of my best friends in high school went on to become an MD. Came back one year from the University of Wisconsin, said one of his professors had told him, it's not so surprising that people get cancer, it's more surprising that all people don't get cancer.
That all people don't get cancer?
Yeah.
Yes.
If cancer just suddenly flares up like a fire, sometimes seemingly at random. So we probably could say that at about most diseases and ailments. So you were speaking about a to-do list for us white boy, that so we wouldn't have to go to the doctor so much. So I'd ask the question, what is the most important thing that all of us could do to prevent or escape illness? With all your experience and even suspicion of the mainline medicine, what medical or non-medical intervention shall we be aware of and start practicing?
Well, I think it's what Jacobus said. I mean, if you had to pick out one thing or say two things, you know, to do, which is keep your weight down to basically a normal weight based on, you know, body mass index, because there are numerous studies showing over and over again that only takes 5 or 10% weight gain to bring on diabetes and to bring on basically some of the cancers like breast cancer, things like that. So basically keeping your weight to normal, and this is an epidemic in this country right now. Doesn't take any medicines, just takes a little, you know, sense of organization. Yeah. And the second thing is a well-balanced diet with increasing fiber and increasing fresh fruits and vegetables, because we're just eating too much beef and too much fat. I think those two issues, you know, keeping your weight down to normal, and those graphs are out there. You can go on the internet, find a body mass index graph. You can plot your basically your weight and your height, and it'll give you the number, which is 25. Body mass index 25 or below is normal. 25 to 30 is overweight, and above 30 is obesity.
Yeah.
And you want to get down around 25 and basically a well-balanced diet. And I think those are the two main issues. It has nothing to do with medicines. It'll keep people healthier and living longer.
Yeah, well, here's another one that I read this in Consumer Reports. So they try to, and they have a newsletter called Consumer Reports on Health, and they said, the one factor that trumps all the others, trumps medicine and even trumps weight, is regular exercise. You're an exercise buff,
right,
too?
Right, yes. Yeah, very important. Aerobic exercise. And those studies are done a lot in the geriatric literature. You know, aerobic exercise. And it's got to be aerobic. You know, getting, you know, it's not weightlifting. It's getting your heart rate up, breathing up, and being weight, you know, dependent. I mean, you know, it's been shown over and over again, you want to be supporting your entire body. So walking, jogging, elliptical machine, actually, because it helps prevent osteoporosis. It's the weight of your body that actually keeps your bones strong.
Yes.
So, you know, this weightlifting to make yourself look better is putting on muscle mass, but it's really not helping cardiopulmonary, your heart, and your lung, and having a basically a weight-dependent exercise where you're carrying your entire body weight is helping your bone structure. So, yeah, I think that's very important. It's been shown actually to decrease diseases and to lengthen life. You know, it's interesting that, I mean, when they look at the numbers, you know, with respect to the healthcare, and that's when Jacobus said something about the 37th, we're 37th in the world, you know, World Health Organization numbers with overall performance. You know, people say, well, how could that possibly be? Well, it turns out, I think the numbers are only, if you look at what creates a healthy population, only 10% is basically your healthcare system that your country has. 40%, I think, is basically lifestyle. You know,
yes,
it's your diet, exercise, what you're doing with weight. I think 30% is genetics, and then there's the 5 or 10% environmental stuff. But really, it comes down to lifestyle. 10% healthcare, your healthcare system, and that's why a lot of our numbers are down, because our lifestyle stinks in this country. There's too much obesity, too much overeating, and not enough exercise.
Yeah.
Well, I got to go meet what's his face. I got to get going.
Thank you, Daniel.
Okay, thanks for
have
coming.
A good weekend. You bet. Good point. I agree with what you say, Dr. Linden. Want to reiterate, I see people who happen to have a fast metabolism, so they are able to keep their weight down no matter what they eat. So I do like your point. Your second point is make sure you have a well-balanced diet, because if just because you are slender built, it doesn't mean that you're healthy. It still depends what you put into your mouth, and because if it doesn't show on the outside, it definitely can start to affect the inside. And osteoporosis is one of the things we often see with women who are more slender build, that they have a higher incidence of osteoporosis as they get older. On the other hand, we see that diabetes can happen to skinny people and heavyweight people. But definitely the weight is becoming, no pun intended, a burden. And it's we have to watch that. So I do like both of those. I also like indeed the exercises, but I understand you say aerobic. There are two things. Number one, I thought that weight, working with weight, is very good to help prevent osteoporosis. Not that I want to emphasize osteoporosis, but I understand it's very good. Number two, is if you do a good circuit workout with weights, working with weights, it is an excellent aerobic exercise as well.
Right.
That's what I thought. All right. We have another caller who would like to talk to you. Caller, good morning to you. Thanks for tuning in today. You're on the air with Dr. Robert Linden, author of The Rise and Fall of the American Medical Empire. What is your name? How can we help you, please?
This is Clint.
Hey, Clint. Good morning.
Good morning there, Jacobus. Good morning, Dr. Linden. Hi.
How you doing, Clint?
Well, I got a statement to make, and then I've got to ask you a question.
Uh-oh. Sounds curious.
Are you ready for this?
Yes. Yes.
In the state of Montana, we have 167 cities dumping their sewer water into our rivers and streams, which wind up eventually in the Mississippi. Then we have cities in Montana and all along the Missouri River taking this water out, trying to retreat it and make it drinkable for the people. I want to know what you think about that. And I want to know what you and Jacobus know about the herb saffron. And I'll hang up and listen, okay?
All right. Thanks, Clint.
Thank you.
You bet.
Sounds like you don't. I don't.
Oops. Go ahead.
I don't know much about Montana, so obviously we live in a town with three nuclear power plants, actually one's closed, and Long Island Sound right at our doorstep, and our government really clamps down on any of this, pollution, and so they're out there with their Geiger counters checking our nuclear power plants all the time, and they've really cleaned up Long Island Sound, and I think that it takes, unfortunately, it takes, and I hate to say it, government regulation of industry, because a lot of these industries really don't have the ethics or the social conscience to clean up their act. And I think Montana's going to have to be responsible for getting involved with, cleaning up the dumping to really get to the problem. I wish industries were more responsible, but unfortunately the bottom line and the profits win out over social responsibility, at least in this country. And we found in the Northeast that unless the governments get involved with it, nothing happens. As far as saffron, I'll be interested in what Jacobus says on that. And as far as saffron, don't know much about it. I'll have to, graciously give that off to Jacobus.
Well, I don't know enough about it. I just know that in the old days when I was a chef, when I went to chef school, saffron was one of those very special spices that you use to make the food look beautifully yellow, but it was also extremely expensive. The best I can do is to tell you what I see on the internet, and it says some components in saffron act as topo II inhibitors, similar to the chemotherapy drug adriamycin. Yet, unlike adriamycin, saffron is non-toxic. Nair noted a dose-dependent cancer effect on carcinoma, sarcoma, and leukemia cells in the test tube. Saffron increased the lifespan of treated mice compared to untreated controls by 45 to 120%. In addition, it delayed the onset of papillomas. So apparently, scientists have also shown that extracts of saffron inhibit cell growth of human tumor cells. Cancer cells treated with crocin had empty areas, reduced cytoplasm, and a destruction of the DNA, all potentially good things for patients. Crocin, they said, is a promising saffron compound to be assayed as a cancer therapeutic agent, and that is really the best I can do. I do know that Clint has been diagnosed with bladder cancer, and he has called the program before. So that is the best I can give you at this point. There is obviously a lot of information available. I wasn't aware that saffron was used. I haven't seen it in a supplement form, but and I don't know exactly how many milligrams you would have to use, Clint, in order to start seeing the benefits, the therapeutic benefits, especially when you're trying to fight cancer. So can't help you there, but there is lots of information available there's absolutely quite a bit of information available on saffron. That's the best I can do. So, Dr. Linden, as we talk about the primary care physician, actually three things, folks, as you're listening to today's program, Gesundheit with Jacobus, in the book, The Rise and Fall of the American Medical Empire, from Dr. Robert Linden, there's the part of the primary care physician, and the wonderful, the intuitiveness, the knowledge, the connection with the patients, the being the quarterback on the medical team. That's one part. There is a part where Dr. Linden talks about the problems that we have. Where's it going wrong with the malpractice suits and with the issues that are coming up in that, the different models that we have? There's five different models. And then we have also, there is a section on the pharmaceutical industry and the issues that are going on with that and the money behind it, and that it is all about the money, and that it has, that really the field of medicine has become a business. And often we, for most of the people who are alive, especially the older generation, you remember the doctor being the one who came to your house, did the house visits, somebody you could connect with, somebody you could meet out on the street and have a little chat with about the weather or whatever. It seems that it is changing. The younger generation starts to know doctors as these people with white coats who are indeed in their office. You got to go visit them. You have long waiting times in the office. You spend a lot of money going in, and you just are going to be broke if you really need to have treatment. So there has been a big change, and that is what is all described in the book. Would you like to talk a little bit more, Dr. Linden, about the primary care physician and why is this such an important part of your book? That you wrote,
right? Okay, yeah. I mean, the first part of the book, as you just said, is the death of primary care, and I think that there's a disappearing primary care segment, and I think that is the closest section of the book to my heart, because that's what I was, and I'm seeing this all the time, and it's a major problem. And just to put it in perspective, I mean, when I went to medical school, like I mentioned before, half the graduating class in my school, plus across the country, 50% of the medical students went into internal medicine residencies. And you have to understand, from a lot of internal medicine residencies, people go in, but they go on to become subspecialists, or a lot of subspecialty sections like radiology or dermatology require 1 year in internal medicine residency before you go into their subspecialty. But 50% of people were going into internal medicine residencies, and 50% of those people were going into primary care internal medicine. And it came out that basically of the 16,000 U.S. medical school graduates, 4,000 were going into primary care medicine across the country.
Yeah.
That number has dropped. 20% of the school class are going into internal medicine residencies. And when they take that number, 20% are going into primary care practice. And the problem is a lot of those people are foreign medical graduates now. We have enough.
Dr. Linden, we're going to continue with that. Stay tuned. We'll be right back on Dr. Linden. Dr. Linden is back with us on the program. Indeed, primary care physicians, these are the people who are the ones that do a lot of the intake of information, who listen to the body, listen to the patient, listen to what they pick up in the voices and in the symptoms, and then say, you know, this is what's going on. And when Dr. Linden went to medical school and he did his internship, he got really inspired by the man Gene Solberg, who was his mentor there, and who had phenomenal bedside manners, and who was very good in finding out what was going on, and then order a test if needed, if necessary. These days, a lot of change. Primary care physicians may be partly caused by the malpractice insurances and the premiums. They're so careful right now, even though they're extremely knowledgeable, have done many, many years of taking of information. It's like they cannot trust themselves anymore. Everything has to be tested. Everything costs money. People are sent from one person to the next person, because if you think about medical doctors going to school and learning about anatomy and learning about disorders and learning about the head and the rump and the lower body, and then all of a sudden they talk to you and they say, well, I rather send you to a specialist. And then the specialist, what the specialist knows nothing else about the body except his little field, and says, well, I better gotta send you to my colleague and he may know better. It seems like there are so many specialists today that know a little bit about the body but don't look at the body as a whole. And for those of you who have seen a movie about Patch Adams, you look indeed at the body as a whole, the person. The person makes the body makes the person. It is integrated. There is a whole individual with experiences and life and love and sadness and happiness behind the disease. And you need to find out who the person is so you can start working with the raw material to bring the body back to life, to bring the body back to health. And that can only be done if there is a cooperation between the person who feels the symptom and the person who understands the symptom and can understands the cause and can help you with the protocol how to get back to life. And that is really the role of a primary care physician, Dr. Linden. And that is, sadly enough, as you observe and as you write about in your book, that is a dying breed.
Right. Yeah, I mean, the number is terrible. I mentioned before the break, I mean, when I graduated, 4,000 U.S. graduates were going into primary care. It's now currently about 500 to 900 for the entire country. And actually, there's a study in 2008 of fourth-year medical students, of which only 2% of the 16 or 17,000 graduating now are interested in primary care, which brings the number of people graduating from medical school and eventually going to primary care internal medicine down about 320, 350 individuals, which is actually the same number of surgeons are going to general surgery, and that's for the entire country. There are 5,000 hospitals in the country. That puts one internist and one surgeon in every hospital every 10 years. And you kind of say, now, you know, how could that possibly be? But to be honest with you, the person that took over my practice, he's the only person that's come and joined an internal medicine practice in our area in the last 12 years, and we're midway between Boston and New York on the coast of Connecticut. I think it's a very desirable area. But if that's the number of people going in, we have a major problem. And like you were saying, I mean, primary care physicians, and for the listeners, a primary care physician by definition is usually a family practitioner, general internist. Pediatricians fall into that group, mm-hmm. and also gynecologists, because they treat a lot of females in childbearing years for general complaints. And those are the primary care core for this country. And when you look at other countries that are far above us, that 37th number that you gave from the WHO, I mean, every other industrialized country, primary care reigns. I mean, there are 60, 70% of the physicians in those countries are primary care physicians. And in our country, it's down around 40%, and there are places like Arizona that I was reading recently, they're down, the primary care physicians are 20% of the physician population. When you look at those countries, you know, primary care really does, like you mentioned, you know, does, you look at the quality goes up, the cost and errors go down, the access of patients to physicians goes up when you have a strong primary care group, and there's a continuity of care. Like you said, primary care physicians will follow you over years and years and years through all your diseases, and there's compassion, you know, like Lee was saying. I mean, the primary care area is pretty much the last remaining area where you get compassion from those physicians. And like you were saying, Jacobus, I mean, the primary care physician should be the captain of the ship.
Yeah.
And they should render most of the care, and they should oversee and coordinate the care when you're going for tests and subspecialty consultations. So having a strong primary care sector is the way to go.
Yes, it is. I'm thinking all of a sudden, it is the difference between when there is a problem in town and the police gets involved, and then all of a sudden the Fed shows up and says, we're going to take over. We know how to play the book. This is what we do. And the police says, but we understand this town. We know how things work. You know, don't take over our job. Let us do our job. And, you know, the feds are saying, no, we're going by the book. And that is almost what is happening with the medical industry as well. Because in a way, and I don't want to toot the horn of natural medicine, but all answers are found in nature. And there are a lot of things that are available if the person, the individual, it's himself or herself, would just feel encouraged that there is a lot of power in themselves to create the healing process. And I still feel that most of it is started with diet and lifestyle, as you mentioned as well. If there's not one, two things that you need to do, or three things, it is your lifestyle, it is keep your weight down, eat a balanced diet, and do exercises. And if people can do that on a daily basis, even if it is, you know, just focusing on it, think about it, work with it, And instead of just giving in to all the temptations that are out there and be lazy, then you cannot expect that you're going to live a long and healthy life. And I tell people on a regular basis as I see them, I say, we cannot afford anymore to get sick. We cannot, not on an individual basis, it is going to ruin you financially. And number two is we don't have enough physicians to take care of all the people who are getting sick. And with the baby boomers coming up, about a third of the America, of the Montana people will be over the age of 65 in about 9 years. And when you think about that, I asked them back in 2004, what are you going to do to help prevention, to take care of the preventive medicine? And the answer I received was, we are building more nursing homes and teaching more nurses. And I said, well, that's not prevention. That is the, that is prevention as far as building something and making money on, but there is no money coming in. There is no money to support this system. We need to educate people how to stay healthy, first of all, and then have a doctor that can be your coach, that can be your supporter, that can be somebody you can bounce ideas off of when there is a problem. Hey, how do I fix this? And say, hey, just do a little bit of this or that and you'll be better. And That has gone away. It has become, nobody dares to answer questions. Everybody is afraid they're going to be sued. And the premiums are very, very high. As you mentioned, $20,000 a year for malpractice insurance premiums. That's ridiculous.
Oh, yeah. Yep. And I forgot to mention, we have to stop smoking and moderate alcohol. We've left that out of the mix when we talk about the exercise, diet, and weight. But, you know, those are the five things I would say. You know,
well, what is left if they'll... Can't smoke and drink anymore.
What am I going to do?
Well, you can drink. I mean, one or two drinks a day is probably healthy for you, but the smoking is out. That's really out. Bad,
Chuck.
Bad.
What are we going to do now, Chuck?
I
shouldn't
know.
Say we. I'm not. But
no.
I don't know if I can say this, but sex is helpful.
Yeah, it is. You can say that. It's a natural word. I think you can find it in the Merriam-Webster dictionary, so it
right.
should be available.
It should be allowable. Question with the old bat.
Oh! I'm sure she's not listening. Are you lucky or what? All right. Now, one of the issues that's coming up, Dr. Linden, is as doctors go to medical school, they have regular visits by pharmaceutical industries representatives. And I know in dentistry school, I know a young man who is going to dentistry school, and he is. They get visited by the people who make all the great equipment, and they get freebies over here and free dental brushes and the latest technologies, and so they're already warming them up for gifts, for bonuses, for their allegiance, so to say, to that specific company, and all of a sudden that starts to work throughout their practice, so that there is not a critical voice anymore that says, hey, wait a second, I like this product from you, but I don't like that, and I don't like that attitude. It's almost like you pledge your allegiance to certain companies who give you the products. You pledge allegiance to the pharmaceutical companies and to the money that is waiting for you if you would just supply or submit yourself to their spiel, so to say.
Right, right. Yep. Yeah, major problem. I mean, actually, I don't know if any of the listeners have seen the movie Love and Other Drugs. I was basically out at a quick stop food place the other day, and I ran into a friend of mine who's an obstetrician who said, you got to go see this movie. You know? And so I went out and saw it, and it's about a drug rep. It's eye-opening, very truthful, although it says docs are going out to conferences and, you know, for sexual encounters and things like that, which isn't true, but the bottom line is that there's this concept of indebtedness, and the pharmaceutical companies know this very well. I mean, the psychology of the pharmaceutical companies and their infiltration into the science and practice of medicine is really interesting, and it starts in the office with the drug representatives who come in and give little gifts, and it's amazing how it doesn't have to be a fancy dinner or a trip to California or Hawaii. It can just be a couple of pieces of pizza for lunch, but it's a concept of, you know, indebtedness or reciprocity, where if you give a gift to somebody, they remember it, and it comes down to you're faced with two blood pressure medicines to give to somebody, and one's generic, it's 3 cents a tablet,
yeah,
and the other is a sample you happen to have in your office given to you by the drug rep that's $3 a tablet, and the person treated you to lunch the week before, and you're going to pick out the drug for $3. And a lot of times they suck you in because they give you samples. You say, well, now I can give the sample to a patient for a month to try out. It's free. If they have a side effect, they haven't wasted any money. And that's all true. But then when they go get the prescription, now they're on it for the rest of their life at $3 a day versus the cheaper generic. Give them the 30 tablets of the generic for $5. And if they have a problem, they've only wasted $5.
Yeah.
But this concept of indebtedness is really, you know, very strong in offices and sucks doctors into prescribing expensive proprietary medicines and staying away from the generics.
But it's a similar thing what happened in 1996 when they started a study on hormone replacement therapy that was supposed to be an 8-year-long study that got cut short in 2001 when so many women were dealing with cancer issues, female-related cancers and heart disease. That was actually an experiment that they didn't know what was going to work. And the test was so many millions of women who participated in that ended up with disorders. And all they said after 5 years, oops, I guess this is not really working as well as we thought. But who was writing, letters of condolences to the families who have lost wives and mothers because of an experimental drug that would really cause more problems than it actually did benefits, gave benefits to the women. So sometimes you're dealing with things that are put on the market that haven't really been tested correctly. And as we see, like with Vioxx and Bacol, some of the drugs out there, they are pushed and the FDA says, okay, it sounds good, the test sounds good, but the tests were done by the company themselves, not really by an independent laboratory. And then all of a sudden, we realize there are problems and the product is taken over the market. And it's like somebody mentioned in a book about vaccinations, and he said, you know, how can we just say that everybody can be vaccinated without a problem? He said, if you would mandate that everybody would eat peanut butter, just like we give everybody vaccinations, we would have a lot of dead people because there are people who get anaphylactic shock just from eating peanuts. And so you cannot just mandate something. You can educate people about it and say it would be a good thing to do, but these are the risks and these are the benefits. And then work with that. Don't you agree with something like that?
Right. Yeah, I mean, and that's a key point. I mean, you know, when a drug hits the market, I mean, it's an amazing number. But it's usually, on the average, been tried in only about 3,000 people. So wow. When the FDA approves a drug, think of it as 3,000 people. Now when it hits the market and hundreds of thousands of people start taking it,
yes,
that's when you start to see the side effects. And that's one of the reasons that the people that, you know, really rail against direct-to-consumer advertising, which is, again, this whole issue of over $5 billion a year spent by the pharmaceutical companies, yeah, to get advertisements on TV, radio, and in your newspaper, yeah, is that basically that's exposing people, millions of people, to a drug the minute it hits the market.
Yeah, and, we have to run again, Dr. Linden.
Okay.
Hold your thought, please. We're
going
to be right back. Robert Linden is with us. Stay tuned, folks. There will be another great hour coming your way. We want to talk about this blatant advertising we see today in the news from pharmaceutical companies. You see people walking out in the field in the sunlight with light clothes on. They're all beautiful people, and they're just dancing around. And then we hear all the great benefits that this medication has. And then the last 12 to 15 seconds of the commercial, we hear somebody speak extremely fast, telling us everything we got to be careful about, which of course nobody's listening to anymore, because all we have is the picture of beauty and success. And sadly enough, we have seen too many problems with medication that is either overprescribed or overpromising and under-delivering.
Right. And I think that, of course, so that quick speaking at the end with the side effects is a requirement from the FDA. And that was the thing that pharmaceutical companies had to give in to. They're not doing that because they want to do it. It's an FDA requirement because when they started with direct-to-consumer advertising, the FDA laid down some ground rules and it pretty much had to explain what was in the package insert, similar to what doctors are reading, and give ways where patients could ask questions with telephone numbers or ask your doctor or things like that.
Right.
But you're right in the fact that that's been the bugaboo of direct-to-consumer advertising, is that it's very glossy, somewhat misleading, and the problem is it fosters this whole concept that you were mentioning earlier in the program about the fact that this concept that there's a medicine for everything,
and people forget that Basie, their lifestyle changes. They, these direct-to-consumer advertisers never mention lifestyle changes. They go directly to the medicine. And for every ailment you have, every pain, every type of disease, there's a medicine, and that's what they're advertising. The other problem is that direct-to-consumer advertising is always for proprietary medicines. These are the brand new, brand name medicines. Of course, they never mention that if there's a group of medicines, you know, a lot of these groups have older medicines that are now gone generic, which are inexpensive. But they never mention those because they're obviously advertisements for this one drug created by the pharmaceutical company sponsoring the ad. I think the major problem, however, with these is what we're alluding to at the end before the break, which is a safety issue. And I think, and these advertisements are started up by the drug companies the first year that these medicines are out. And so you have now a study, an FDA has accepted this medicine, but based on 3,000 people, of which you're not going to really, you know, develop a good side effect profile, and now you have it going out to millions of people that are going to take it. And I think that the medicine you mentioned before, Vioxx, is the best example of this. I mean, you know, the study was basically a study, and Vioxx is a COX-2 inhibitor, it's called. These are arthritis pills that were supposed to be unique in the fact they took away inflammation in joints, but they did not bother your stomach. Yes. So they were different from naproxen and ibuprofen, Motrin and aspirin, because those medicines will basically, again, take away your joint pains, but also could cause stomach upset. These medicines did not affect the lining of the stomach. But they also wouldn't block prostaglandins. You know, again, they wouldn't be like aspirin, where they would help prevent heart disease.
Yeah.
And so the first study out basically showed a slight, it was Vioxx versus an older non-steroidal anti-inflammatory called naproxen, and there was some increase in heart disease seen. And the answer of the company was, well, that where it's not that Vioxx is causing heart disease, it's naproxen, what we're going against in the study, was actually preventing heart disease. And some questions were brought up. Doctors hadn't seen the study. The FDA had accepted the medicine based on that study. And also that study came out after Vioxx was on the market. But when the questions came about the safety, that's when Merck started the whole advertisement, you know, campaign. And I think some of us remember Darcy Hamill, you know, lacing up her skates and sliding across the ice skating rink, basically expressing how the Vioxx was helping her arthritis. And that was a $100 million ad campaign.
Wow.
That was started while Merck knew that there was probably a problem with this medicine. And it wasn't until a study that actually, some of these medicines actually, we think, prevent colon polyps. And it wasn't until basically a study was Vioxx versus placebo. So it wasn't against another medicine, it was versus nothing, a pill that had nothing in it, to see if they prevented colon polyps. It did. But there was also an increased incidence of heart disease and stroke, and the medicine was withdrawn from the market.
Yeah.
But that was only after, I think, you know, it had clocked sales of like $80 billion or something across the world globally.
Huh. Wow.
And basically, I think 80 million people were taking this medicine. And then it was withdrawn. And a lot of that basically enrollment of patients into this medicine was based on direct to consumer advertising.
Wow.
So, there are a lot of people that advocate that new medicines should not be advertised on TV, that they should be out for a year or two first so we can try them in thousands of people before we expose them to expose the entire country to these ads on TV and radio and newspapers.
Plus, let's not forget that reports are coming out that when a test is done on a group of people, that sometimes the negative ones are just thrown out in order to make the number look better.
Right.
You know? Go ahead.
Yeah. That's a key point. I mean, I think that's a major problem with the literature, and that's a major problem with also the drug companies have gotten into. They're basically funding about 70% of any study you see done on a drug in this country. 70% of those studies are funded by the drug company sponsoring that drug.
Yeah.
And so what's happened, and they have control over, they shouldn't have control, and there are some laws against this now, but somehow they do still control what's published and what isn't. And for a variety of reasons, the negative studies just aren't published. So a negative study being the medicine didn't do anything.
Right.
And so those studies get buried, whether the researcher is not, you know, basically
you know, stops the study because nothing's happening, or the journal doesn't think it's interesting enough because the study, the medicine didn't do anything, or the pharmaceutical company has a way of squelching the study. The bottom line is negative studies don't get published. It's called publication bias. And what's made worse is what we see a lot now is what's called a meta-analysis. And that's based on the fact that there may be numerous small studies with not a lot of people enrolled. And the numbers don't reach statistical significance. And so what they do is they lump all the 10 studies together to create more people to generate numbers. Well, if you are lumping the studies in the journals together that have left out the negative studies, you can see where the whole meta-analysis gets skewed to a positive result on the medicine.
Wow.
And that's become more and more of a problem. And for that reason, the FDA and these journal editors are now requiring all studies to be registered, so that as soon as a study starts, it's registered. So if it doesn't make it into a journal article or something like that, the results of that study are still available for everybody to see if it's a negative study.
We have a caller who is patiently waiting to talk to you. Caller, good morning. Thanks for your patience. What is your name? How can we help you, please?
Is it me who's on?
It is you who's on.
Yeah, I have a kind of a multi-pronged question. I know that we only graduate so many medical students a year. And I know so many doctors are retiring, and I understand that we need more family doctors than we do. Or is it true that are we going to need more specialists also? And I know we're importing a lot of doctors from foreign countries, and we're also trying to educate a lot more nurses to be nurse practitioners and physician assistants.
Yeah.
So there's this whole combination of things that are coming down. So what I want to know is, are we going to need more specialists? And what are those specialists we're going to be needing? And if I actually have a daughter in medical school now, and she's trying to decide what she wants to do, and she's finding with internal medicine, one of the things that's frustrating her is that when patients don't take care of themselves and when they don't heed all the things that Jacobus is talking about exercise and diet and weight, and you encourage them, and you are a life coach, but it's not happening. And as a young person, you know, they want things quickly, but also and she realized all the social ills, but it's been very hard for her to think about being a family doctor because of what she's up against. And then I just wanted to also ask about a student's natural talents. I mean, someone might be naturally a really good surgeon, or they might be a really good at a specialty, and I just want to know, what are the needs of specialty? We can't just have no specialists, and so kind of a multi-pronged question. I'm curious what the doctor has to say.
Yeah, stay on the line, because if we miss one of your questions, then we can answer that. Dr. Linden.
Yeah, those are great questions. Actually right now, I mean, historically, about 16,000 people have graduated from medical school in this country every year, and that's been constant for years. There's a big push to sort of increase that, and the problem with that big push is that right now, if medical schools continue this idea that they're swaying people away from primary care into subspecialties, and they do that because they don't have a lot of role models for subspecialties, for primary care. They basically also probably dump on primary care a lot. They also basically, you know, primary care people could be heroes in their communities, in a small community, but they just don't write the articles for New England Journal of Medicine or JAMA. They don't get in the front of Time Magazine, you know, Newsweek. And so they don't bring sort of, you know, basically reputation prestige to the medical school. So the medical schools are more interested in turning out subspecialists. So they're really, medical schools are sort of reneging, I think, on their responsibility to turning out primary care. And the fear of people in primary care is that even though we increase the numbers, slots in medical schools, that they're just going to end up turning out more subspecialists and not more primary care.
Mm-hmm.
We don't have in this country, like in Europe, workforce committees. And what a workforce committee is a group of people that go out into the communities of the country, both in the rural areas and the cities, and see what we really need. As physicians, are we down on primary care? Are we down on cardiologists? Do we need more gastroenterologists for stomachs? We don't have that. Most other countries, number one, support their medical schools financially, and number two, have workforce committees. And so the government's able to go out and say, hey, we're down on primary care,
And they come back to the medical schools and they say, hey, look, you know, we need you to turn out 10% more internists or primary care physicians over the next 5 years, or we're going to withhold funding. Yes. We don't have that. In this country, the medical schools pretty much run the show. And so they're going to turn out who they want to turn out, and the government really has no control of that. Do we need more subspecialists? The problem right now is that, you know, doctors gravitate to, really, there's no pressure on them to sort of go out into the rural areas or the underserved areas. And what subspecialists tend to do is they gravitate to suburban areas for culture, for increased salaries and things like that. They don't end up in the underserved rural areas of this country. So that's another problem turning out more subspecialists. And also subspecialists, like Kovas was referring to before, are expensive. That model of having a subspecialty-based model, which we're the only country that has that, is extremely expensive. If you think about it, you know, a good internist should be able to take care of, you know, your diabetes, your lung disease, your angina in one visit, you know, under one roof. And a subspecialty-based model, which is what we're approaching in this country, now, instead of that one internist, you have three doctors. You have a cardiologist for your angina, you have a Joslin clinic or a diabetologist for your diabetes, you have a lung doctor for your emphysema. Three doctors, they each charge maybe 1.5 to 3 times more than the internist, so you have three visits, each visit more expensive than the internist. And then subspecialists use a lot more technology. They just don't do a lot of bedside diagnosis, because some of them because they don't know how to do it, and others because they think the buck stops with them. They cannot make a mistake. They're the specialist. And so they're the people who are going to order more technology. So that's very expensive. So I think right now when you go through the subspecialists, to answer your question, I think we have enough subspecialists, but we have to turn out more primary care. I agree that, you know, that it is frustrating in a primary care office when people come in and they don't listen to you. They continue to smoke, and they continue to, you know, remain obese. They don't follow diets. But there's also a satisfaction there. If you talk to any primary care doctor, I mean, especially in a rural area, they're part of the community. The patients are their friends and neighbors. They do make inroads on that patient's medical illness. And there is a satisfaction you get from that versus being a subspecialist in a city where you're treating a bunch of people, but you don't know them. You'll never see them on the street. You'll never see them in your church or your school system because it's a large city. Where in my town, for example, 15,000, I mean, I you know, my patients, I saw all the time on the street. And again, they were my friends, and they really, it was a satisfying experience. So I really, you know, would bring that home to your daughter, that she can derive satisfaction. Hopefully things will change with a variety of things that are being done, but it's going to take a big, big push because we have a generation problem now, too. I mean, a lot of people graduate from medical school, the millennials, they want their 40-hour work weeks, they want their nights, they want their weekends, and unfortunately, that's not available in primary care. I mean, you have to sort of put in the time, and there is a lot of night and weekend call.
Yeah.
I mean, does that answer some
of the question? Yeah, it does. But, and then, you know, I mean, I agree with you, you know, 99% about everything you're saying, and then to actually watch someone go through this process of the gruel of medical school and everything, and then, you know, then you get back up to, you know, what primary care physicians are paid. And it's just, you know, when we know how they're so undervalued. And so that, I'm sure, weighs on a lot of students because they've got these hefty bills and with the economy. And I don't know if you're going to – I know there's lots of programs out there in rural areas where they're trying to attract students, helping them with their loans and, you know, a variety of ways. But I'm sure the financial impact of medical school makes, you know, big, you know, influences students as to what they need to do.
Well, you know, I want to jump on that for a second. That is an interesting concept that you bring, caller. But it is the same as what is going on with the healthcare system, is that it doesn't, you know, you never have a blue light special with in a doctor's visit. It's always a certain price. You never can go to the pharmacist and say, hey, I tell you what, you know, ask of whatever medication you need. It's on sale this whole month. You actually find a great price. We do something. There is never a sale on pharmaceutical drugs, and there is never a sale on doctor's visits. So it's the same with medical school. They can charge whatever they want because they know the student eventually is going to pay for it. And that is, so the quality of education or what you're really trying to get out of it as a student is not always there, but you still end up paying the bill. And it is sadly enough the same as what's happening with the drugs that people buy. They don't always know the long-term side effects, but they do have to pay for them no matter what. You cannot bring it back and say, well, you know, I tried it for a week. I don't really like it. Can I get my money back? You know, and that is I feel the cost of medical school, it's anybody can set a price. If there are people who flock to that school and they want to go through those 4 or 5 or 6 year study, they'll pay for it. They're underpaying for it. So they can get away with it with charging whenever they want to charge. And that is why the loans that students have to pay back in real life are going to be there no matter how you look at it.
Right. What did the doctor, what did you say?
I just want to throw one thing in. But coming back to your question, it's really interesting because actually a friend of mine is an infectious disease physician at Brown University in Rhode Island, and he brought up the exact same point you're bringing up, that the only people going into primary care are the rich students. Because the rich students basically, number one, have no loans to pay off, and number two, they have income from other means through their families, and they don't make income from their vocation. The vocational income is not important. So they're the ones going to primary care, where everybody else is graduating with, like you said, I think the number is like 25% of graduating medical schools have debts of over $200,000. And you're right. I mean, you can't take an internal medicine. They make 55% of what a subspecialist makes. And so you're taking a person that's going to make half the income and graduating them with a $200,000 debt. And what are they going to do? They're going to go into a subspecialty, like you said. And I think there are ways to sort of, you know,
Dr. Linden, we're going to have to keep your thought again. I know that you may not hear the music in the background, but we are running up to a break here.
Okay.
Paula, I'm sorry, we can't continue with this. We'll jump on it when we come back out of the break. Stay tuned for another half hour. We'll be right back. Caller, good morning. Your name, please. How can we help you?
My name is Steve, and what a terrific program.
Thanks, Steve.
I'm concerned about health and all the domains of health and development, and I'm thinking that so we have over time unconsciously a certain kind of relationship with industrialization of our food, our medicine. I think there's a lot more awareness now of the consequences, some of those consequences or benefits. And your program does a great job of this, of making us discriminating thinkers. And the doctor today makes such a good point that I want a healthcare provider that travels along with me through my life, knows me, I know him, her. And talk about domains of health, we begin to lose an important intimacy, I think, as human beings for development and health by being apart in some time with these industrialized systems. We become a part of our food system. We become distanced from important things. So that's my comment, and I'd like to have a response. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Steve. You want to stay on the line, or are you going to hang up?
Oh, I can stay.
All right. Dr. Linden.
Yep, I agree. I think that it's interesting in taking medicine specifically, because I think we're at a junction right now that, as far as physicians and patients, you know, a junction where you have a major problem with the ages. I'm not sure what age Steve is, but, you know, between 50 to 70 age group, where basically they're used to what Steve had mentioned, you know, physicians that have been there for 20 or 30 years, that practice continuity care, that have followed patients, that admit their patients when they get sick to the hospital, that are available at night. Some of them are still doing house calls. And yet the new doctors coming out are, you know, again, hate to use the term again, but millennials, people that have reversed the priorities in their life, you know, that instead of vocation coming first and family second and them third, their quality of life comes first, family maybe second, and then their profession really is down third or fourth. And they want the 40-hour work weeks. They don't want the nights or the weekends. But, you know, the patients at that age are also the same. They don't have a sense of loyalty. I know my son-in-law is interesting. Wanted to buy a car. There's a Subaru dealership 2 blocks away from his house. Did he buy it from there? No. He went on the computer and said, I want to spend $25,000 for this Subaru. You give me bids. And 5 Subaru dealerships answered him, and he bought the car someplace that's 60 or 70 miles away. I said, where are you going to get service? Down the street at the Subaru place 2 blocks away. I said, well, how can you buy the car one place and get service locally? Aren't they going to discriminate against you? They don't care. And that's where the new group of patients is, too. There's no loyalty. They go to supermarket number one because the cost is down, and they don't develop a relationship with one supermarket or one doctor or one automobile dealership. Where the people that are between 50 and 70 are very upset now because they're losing their doctors, number one. And when they get sick, they end up at the hospital and they end up being taken care of by a hospitalist. Yeah. And there's a whole changeover now. Maybe in 30 years from now, nobody's going to be complaining. We're going to have the millennials treating the millennials and nobody cares. But I think right now, like you mentioned, there's a major change where the providers are young and their priorities are different and the consumers are 30 or 40 years older with a lot of diseases, and they aren't used to this young generation of physicians, and I think there's going to be a war out there and a lot of discontent.
Wow, I hear what you're saying, and I also think, like I said, we've kind of become, you said, people like automatons walk into these specialists and don't think much of it. We're involved in our industrialized food and meat system, don't think, but I think the awareness is greater, and that's what I'm saying. I am optimistic that there are lifelong students of the profession who want to do what you're talking about, and I see a generation doing this in the food system and not putting a monetary thing at the top. It's necessary for all of us, of course, and there's a role for testing, there's a role for specialists, but I'm talking about a very important human component.
And
that's what I'm talking about in all of these systems, and a kind of distancing, whether it's from nature or human beings, that I think I'm positive about a change in the future. But we've gotten ourselves into a lot of muck, I think, industrialization.
Uh-huh.
Right. And I think there are a lot of students out there that are interested in doing the primary care, doing the blood and guts medicine, but they have to be selected and nurtured. And I think that one of the basic problems I see are the medical schools and how they're selecting people and how they're brainwashing them from year one through four. I mean, there are a lot of medical students that come out into medical school bright-eyed and bushy-tailed, want to conquer the world, want to take care of the underserved, want to go into the rural areas. And by the time they finish those 4 years, they're indoctrinated into thinking about quality of life, incomes. And they come out basically in this, like you said, the medical industrial complex and going into subspecialties. And I think that it's well known that if medical schools changed their admission policies and took kids more from state schools rather than private schools, took kids more from the rural areas than the urban areas, took actually the females we know go into primary care more than males, and changed their admissions policies and nurtured those kids through the 4 years, I think we'd have, like you said, an optimistic view, and we'd have more role models for these kids. We're going to turn out more primary care. And I hate to come down to the medical schools, but I think one of our major problems is changing the medical system. And there are medical schools that are changing. I mean, basically Jefferson and University of Washington and University of North Carolina really are pushing primary care. Mm. And I think if more medical schools jumped on the bandwagon, we would turn out more primary care physicians.
Well, thanks for the call, Steve.
You bet. Thank you.
Bye-bye. This is Gesundheit with Jacobus. My guest on the phone is Dr. Robert Linden, author, a retired family physician and internist and geriatric specialist. And The Rise and Fall of the American Medical Empire is his book. We have another caller who would like to ask you a question or give us a comment. Caller, good morning. Your name, please. How can we help you?
Yeah, this is Tom.
Hey, Tom.
And, basically, I'm very conservative, values, philosophy, everything like that and all. And I was, first of all, interested in the medical school and the cost structure and the doctor thing and everything very much. We're going through, there's a big echo.
There was somebody else on hold. We're going through a
real serious thing with skin cancer with my wife now. She's lost about 3/4 of her nose and had a major session in the Billings Clinic and just came from a week's surgery in Salt Lake and everything like that. And I don't want to interfere with anyone's ability to make money or with a student's ability to go where they want or do this. It's not, it's against. But while I think I abhor the way Obamacare was put together because it's just absolutely unaffordable and it just, you know, can't be done that way. They got to rebuild it, although I know we have a lot of need. But the problem is we have just two of about eight surgeries, the bills in so far for her, and that's like over $33,000 already. And I don't get it. When we left the hospital in Salt Lake, and she only stayed overnight one night, she couldn't come out of the anesthetic. They gave us bags and bags of saline and patches and tapes and pads. And they said, you better take it, stuff we didn't even need. And I said, why do we take all this? She said, because you're going to get charged for it anyway. Thousands of dollars. And just, we're out of control. We're just absolutely out of control. I know we can't afford Obamacare because of this kind of thing, but I don't understand where the cost structure comes from. The people at the hospital says, well, we got to run the hospital. What's going on?
That's a great point, Dr. Linden.
What is going on? What on earth is going on? That, you know, athletes, I know athletes get it because they can. If fans would stay out of the ballparks and make it handle some of that problem, but athletes get millions more than true value because it's inflated, they can get it. But where does our cost structure in medicine? I research, I know all of this, all of that. But, you know, one handful's enough, and I've got pretty heavy insurance where we're getting pretty well things fixed. It's going to cost us a bundle, but, God, other people that have these kind of things, where do they go? What do they do?
Yeah.
I'll get off. Thank you.
Thank you, Tom.
Yeah, I mean, that's a whole other, you know, hour, and I think that with respect to our healthcare insurance structure and our healthcare system structure, but a lot of it comes down to basically in our country, the way we have it set up, there's a lot of overhead, a lot of administration. When you look at it, 30 cents of every dollar paid for your premium goes to overhead and administration, and a lot of that's going to CEO salaries in the millions and stock options given to the CEOs. A lot of it's gone into the paperwork that insurance companies use, the for-profits, figuring out weird things, things like how not to insure people, what to set the rates at, denial processes, things like that. When you put into it, again, much of medicine is Wall Street medicine. It's basically companies that are destined to supply stockholders with dividends every year. And again, we've gotten to this whole establishment, and unfortunately, you know, like you said, you're a conservative, so it's hard to kind of, it's a little difficult to review, but basically we've become, like Cobus said earlier in the program, we've become a business, and every area in medicine is destined to generate profits for stockholders and things like that, which is part of the problem. Another problem with our present system is we talked about the fact that we're a subspecialty based system, and that's very expensive for the reason we talked about. Something we haven't talked about is defensive medicine, which is basically the fact that these doctors are scared stiff of being sued, and so they overtest. And as Lee said at the outset of the program, when you overtest, you find ditzels, you find all kinds of things on CT scans that probably don't mean anything. They're cysts or benign nodules. They're very small, but who's to say they're not going to be cancer?
So the false positives?
Right. They've done this. They're into doing these tests over and over again for 2 years, 3 years, because that's what the radiologists want. They want rock stable stability, and before they'll say it's benign, and that creates a lot of costs, a lot of anxiety, and this whole thing with radiation. And we have the patients. The patients are demanding more and more technology. I mean, and they, like Lee said earlier, if they don't get it, they threaten to sue you. So we have a lot of things built into our medical system that makes it expensive, and actually twice as expensive as our closest competitor.
We're also being told that if you have insurance, or the insurance company will pay for it. People would just go to a doctor and say, well, I already hit my deductible, so I can just keep going because it's all paid for by the insurance company. Well, somebody's got to pay for it, you know? And that is where is this feeling of responsibility? Like, what can I do myself in order to avoid this disaster which we're in and which we're going to end in, you know, if the whole system starts working the way it has been presented by the government right now? I do want to get another caller in before, and I know that, as you mentioned, the question from Tom could take us another hour, and I think we got to keep that in mind for another show, Dr. Linden. I want to get another caller in. Caller, good morning to you. Thank you for your patience. Your name, please. How can we help you?
Yes, my name is Judy, and I'm so glad he brought up the subject of Vioxx, and I'll tell you what my experience was. When it first came out, my rheumatologist doctor put me on Vioxx, and by the time I'd taken the second pill, because I was on warfarin, blood thinners, I went and I got pneumonia. I spent 3 weeks in the hospital, very, very, very ill. You can't mix the warfarin with the Vioxx, we found out. So when I got out of the hospital, we didn't think to renew my pneumonia shot. And 3 months later, I went back in the hospital with pneumonia, was put in ICU, and spent 3 months on a ventilator.
Oh, boy, Judy.
I tell you, that Vioxx was something else. It didn't hurt my heart, thank goodness, but it sure made me ill. And they thought I was going to die the second time.
Wow.
So I often wanted to sue that company for that pill.
Yeah. You did? Or you wanted to?
No, I didn't. But I've often thought, boy, they sure made it miserable for me.
Yeah, and they probably raked up your costs on stuff that was never necessary. Huh?
Yeah, I did have insurance, thank heavens, or yes. I'd have been out in the street.
Yeah. Dr. Linden.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, it's a tough case not knowing all the details, because the Vioxx was, I mean, Vioxx and Celebrex, which is a sister medicine from Pfizer, which actually still is on the market, they were touted as not affecting your clotting system. They don't block platelets. And so they weren't going to be like aspirin and naproxen, and that's probably why your physician selected Vioxx. But the problem with warfarin is that any medicine, I mean, there are certain medicines out there that can change your prothrombin time on the warfarin, the Coumadin, the blood thinner, but I think you have to sort of take almost any medicine can change levels of warfarin or prothrombin time, and you have to really, if you're going to start any new medicine on a person, especially a medicine that just came on the market,
right,
which again, you're coming back to 3,000 to 5,000 people are tested on this, and they don't. When they do these tests, something I didn't mention is there are a lot of exclusions. You know, when these companies design these studies, there are exclusions. They exclude older people. They exclude people on medicines like warfarin. They exclude people with other diseases. So they're using a very, very narrow group of people, and then they're getting passed through the FDA and increase. And now these medicines are used on a lot of people, people who are 80 years old, people that have diabetes and hypertension, people that are on numerous other medicines, and then you start to see the side effects.
Yes.
And that's what you went into. So
yes. Well, thank you, doctor.
Well, thank you, Judy.
For your good information. Yes.
Okay, Judy.
Thank you for listening.
Bye.
All right. We have a few more minutes here. You know, Dr. Linden, just to close out this program, but I really love to have you back because there's so much more we need to touch. Your book, 200 and some pages, 250 or so pages, with great information and insights, it's really only the tip of the iceberg, because we can go into so much more detail as we do that. One of the things that I've brought up on this program that I just want to run by you in just a nutshell, maybe for food for thought for next show, is the system that is being proposed and that is being accepted of being the past that we're going to implement in the so-called Obamacare. It is primarily taking care of the pharmaceutical companies, insurance companies, the doctors, the hospitals, etc. There is no proposal for integrative medicine using natural approaches, the research that is being done in natural approaches in combination with what we call then the establishment of Wall Street. I have said before, let's say we would stimulate the American people to live a healthy life, to exercise, to have a chiropractic visit, acupuncture, go to a gym, get a gym membership, buy some vitamins and supplements if that's what they feel they need, use those so-called alternative methods and save the receipts. And at the end, at tax time, you just take those receipts, deduct them from your taxes, deduct them from your income, whatever you want to do, and then pay taxes on everything else you have to pay your taxes on. But right now, come tax time, all these expenses that are there really to make the person healthier from the inside out and the outside in, are considered a luxury. They're not seen as an actual way to make this nation healthier. And because people are not stimulated in doing that, all of a sudden when the economy hits, they're going to say, well, I know I got to take care of myself, but my insurance will cover it. I'm not going to go that route. And I know it's too short for you to give a long answer, but I know you have done your readings and your studying. We're going to have to talk about that another time.
Yeah, I think it all comes down to special interest and profits. And I think the free things that are make common sense are left out of the equation because the special interests were left in the legislation.
Absolutely. And there's more.
A lot of people feel that they wrote this legislation.
I see. Well, that's a great point. I really appreciate that we can close on that. I want to thank you so much for writing the book, The Rise and Fall of the American Medical Empire. I highly suggest people pick up the copy, and I hope to look forward and talking to you again soon.
Okay. Well, thank you very much for having me.
Thank you very much for being with us.